Chapter 29. That I may do worse than choose her. Angel waxed quite earnest on that rather automatic orthodoxy in his beloved Tess, which never dreaming that it might stand him in such good stead, he had been prone to slight when observing it practiced by her and the other milkmaids, because of its obvious unreality amid beliefs essentially naturalistic. In their sad doubts as to whether their son had himself any right whatever to the title he claimed for the unknown young woman, Mr. and Mrs. Clare began to feel it as an advantage not to be overlooked, that she at least was sound in her views, especially as the conjunction of the pair must have arisen by an act of providence, for Angel never would have made orthodoxy a condition of his choice. They said finally that it was better not to act in a hurry, but that they would not object to see her. Angel therefore refrained from declaring more particulars now. He felt that, single-minded and self-sacrificing as his parents were, there yet existed certain latent prejudices of theirs, as middle-class people, which it would require some tact to overcome. For though legally at liberty to do as he chose, and though their daughter-in-law's qualifications could make no practical difference to their lives, in the probability of her living far away from them, he wished for affection's sake not to wound their sentiment in the most important decision of his life. He observed his own inconsistencies in dwelling upon accidents in Tess's life as if they were vital features. It was for herself that he loved Tess, her soul, her heart, her substance, not for her skill in the dairy, her aptness as his scholar, and certainly not for her simple formal faith professions. Her unsophisticated open-air existence required no varnish of conventionality to make it palatable to him. He held that education had as yet but little affected the beats of emotion and impulse on which domestic happiness depends. It was probable that, in the lapse of ages, improved systems of moral and intellectual training would appreciably, perhaps considerably, elevate the involuntary and even the unconscious instincts of human nature, but up to the present day culture, as far as he could see, might be said to have affected only the mental epiderm of those lives which had been brought under its influence. This belief was confirmed by his experience of women, which, having latterly been extended from the cultivated middle class into the rural community, had taught him how much less was the intrinsic difference between the good and wise woman of one social stratum and the good and wise woman of another social stratum than between the good and bad, the wise and the foolish, of the same stratum or class. It was the morning of his departure. His brothers had already left the vicarage to proceed on a walking tour in the north, whence one was to return to his college, and the other to his curacy. Angel might have accompanied them, but preferred to rejoin his sweetheart at Talbothays. He would have been an awkward member of the party, for, though the most appreciative humanist, the most ideal religionist, even the best-versed Christologist of the three, there was a lionation in the standing consciousness that his squareness would not fit the round hole that had been prepared for him. To neither Felix nor Cuthbert had he ventured to mention Tess. His mother made him sandwiches, and his father accompanied him, on his own mare, a little way along the road. Having fairly well advanced his own affairs, Angel listened in a willing silence, as they jogged on together through the shady lanes, to his father's account of his parish difficulties, and the coldness of brother clergymen whom he loved, because of his strict interpretations of the New Testament by the light of what they deemed a pernicious Calvinistic doctrine. "Pernicious," said Mr. Clare, with genial scorn. And he proceeded to recount experiences which would show the absurdity of that idea. He told of wondrous conversions of evil livers, of which he had been the instrument, not only amongst the poor, but amongst the rich and well-to-do, and he also candidly admitted many failures. As an instance of the latter, he mentioned the case of a young upstart squire named D'Urberville, living some 40 miles off, in the neighborhood of Trantridge. "Not one of the ancient D'Urbervilles of Kingsbere and other places?" asked his son. That curiously historic worn-out family with its ghostly legend of the coach and four? Oh no! The original d'Urbervilles decayed and disappeared 60 or 80 years ago at least, I believe so. This seems to be a new family which had taken the name. For the credit of the former knightly line, I hope they are spurious, I'm sure. But it is odd to hear you express interest in old families. I thought you set less store by them even than I. You misapprehend me, Father, you often do, said Angel with a little impatience. Politically, I am skeptical as to the virtue of their being old. Some of the wise even among themselves exclaim against their own succession, apostrophe as Hamlet puts it. But lyrically, dramatically, and even historically, I am tenderly attached to them. This distinction, though by no means a subtle one, was yet too subtle for Mr. Clare the Elder, and he went on with the story he had been about to relate, which was that after the death of the senior, so-called d'Urberville, the young man developed the most culpable passions, though he had a blind mother, whose condition should have made him no better. A knowledge of his career, having come to the ears of Mr. Clare, when he was in that part of the country preaching missionary sermons, he boldly took occasion to speak to the delinquent on his spiritual state. Though he was a stranger, occupying another's pulpit, he had felt this to be his duty, and took for his text the words from St. Luke: Thou fool, this night thy soul shall be required of thee. The young man much resented this directness of attack, and in the war of words which followed, when they met, he did not scruple publicly to insult Mr. Clare, without respect for his gray hairs. Angel flushed with distress. Dear Father, he said sadly, I wish you would not expose yourself to such gratuitous pain from scoundrels. Pain? Said his father, his rugged face shining in the ardor of self-abnegation. He only pained to me was pain on his account, poor, foolish young man. Do you suppose his incensed words could give me any pain, or even his blows? Being reviled we bless, being persecuted we suffer it, being defamed we entreat. We are made as the filth of the world, and as the offscouring of all things unto this day. ... Those ancient and noble words to the Corinthians are strictly true at this present hour. Not blows, Father? He did not proceed to blows? No, he did not. Though I have borne blows from men in a mad state of intoxication. No. A dozen times, my boy. What then? I have saved them from the guilt of murdering their own flesh and blood thereby, and they have lived to thank me, and praise God. May this young man do the same, said Angel fervently. But I fear otherwise, from what you say. We'll hope, nevertheless, said Mr. Clare. And I continue to pray for him, though on this side of the grave we shall probably never meet again. But, after all, one of those poor words of mine may spring up in his heart as a good seed someday. Now, as always, Clare's father was sanguine as a child, and though the younger could not accept his parents' narrow dogma, he revered his practice, and recognized the hero under the pietist. Perhaps he revered his father's practice even more now than ever, seeing that, in the question of making Tessie his wife, his father had not once thought of inquiring whether she were well provided or penniless. The same unworldliness was what had necessitated Angel's getting a living as a farmer, and would probably keep his brothers in the position of poor parsons for the term of their activities. Yet Angel admired it nonetheless. Indeed, despite his own heterodoxy, Angel often felt that he was nearer to his father on the human side than was either of his brethren. XXVII, an uphill and downhill ride of 20-odd miles through a garish midday atmosphere brought him in the afternoon to a detached knoll a mile or two west of Talbothays, whence he again looked into that green trough of sappiness and humidity, the valley of the Varfroom. Immediately he began to descend from the upland to the fat alluvial soil below. The atmosphere grew heavier. The languid perfume of the summer fruits, the mists, the hay, the flowers, formed there a vast pool of odor which at this hour seemed to make the animals, the very bees and butterflies, drowsy. Claire was now so familiar with the spot that he knew the individual cows by their names when, a long distance off, he saw them dotted about the meads. It was with a sense of luxury that he recognized his power of viewing life here from its inner side, in a way that had been quite foreign to him in his student days. And, much as he loved his parents, he could not help being aware that to come here, as now, after an experience of home life, affected him like throwing off splints and bandages. Even the one customary curb on the humors of English rural societies being absent in this place, Talbothays having no resident landlord. Not a human being was out of doors at the dairy. The denizens were all enjoying the usual afternoon nap of an hour or so, which the exceedingly early hours kept in summertime rendered a necessity. At the door, the wood-hooped pails, sodden and bleached by infinite scrubbings, hung like hats on a stand upon the forked, unpeeled limb of an oak fixed there for that purpose. All of them ready and dry for the evening milking. Angel entered and went through the silent passages of the house to the back quarters, where he listened for a moment. Sustained snores came from the cart house, where some of the men were lying down. The grunt and squeal of sweltering pigs arose from the still further distance. The large-leaved rhubarb and cabbage plants slept too, their broad limp surfaces hanging in the sun like half-closed umbrellas. He unbridled and fed his horse, and as he re-entered the house the clock struck three. Three was the afternoon skimming hour, and, with the stroke, Claire heard the creaking of the floorboards above, and then the touch of a descending foot on the stairs. It was Tess's, who in another moment came down before his eyes. As he had not heard him enter, and hardly realized his presence there. She was yawning, and he saw the red interior of her mouth, as if it had been a snake's. She had stretched one arm so high above her coiled up cable of hair, that he could see its satin delicacy above the sunburn. Her face was flushed with sleep, and her eyelids hung heavy over their pupils. The brim fullness of her nature breathed from her. It was a moment when a woman's soul is more incarnate than at any other time, when the most spiritual beauty bespeaks itself flesh, and sex takes the outside place in the presentation. Then those eyes flashed brightly through their filmy heaviness, before the remainder of her face was well awake. With an oddly compounded look of gladness, shyness, and surprise, she exclaimed, "Mr. Clare, how you frightened me!" I there had not at first been time for her to think of the changed relations which his declaration had introduced, but the full sense of the matter rose up in her face when she encountered Claire's tender look as he stepped forward to the bottom stair. "Dear, darling Tessie," he whispered, putting his arm round her and his face to her flushed cheek. "Aunt, for heaven's sake, mister me any more. I have hastened back so soon because of you." Tess's excitable heart beat against his by way of reply, and there they stood upon the red brick floor of the entry, the sun slanting in by the window upon his back, as he held her tightly to his breast, upon her inclining face, upon the blue veins of her temple, upon her naked arm, and her neck, and into the depths of her hair. Having been lying down in her clothes, she was warm as a sun cat. At first she would not look straight up at him, but her eyes soon lifted, and his plumb the deepness of the ever-varying pupils, with their radiating fibrils of blue, and black, and gray, and violet, while she regarded him as Eve at her second waking might have regarded Adam. "I've got to go a-skimming," she pleaded, "and I have on the old Deb to help me today. Mrs. Crick is gone to market with Mr. Crick, and Reddy is not well, and the others are gone out somewhere, and won't be home till milking." As they retreated to the milk house, Deborah Finder appeared on the stairs. "I have come back, Deborah," said Mr. Clare, upwards, "so I can help Tess with the skimming, and, as you are very tired, I am sure, you needn't come down till milking time." Possibly the Talbothays milk was not very thoroughly skimmed that afternoon. Tess was in a dream wherein familiar objects appeared as having light and shade and position, but no particular outline. Every time she held the skimmer under the pump, to cool it for the work, Gutenberg edition. End of chapter.